I am finally here. It's 1:30 in the afternoon in Northern California. Wow, did I go down a rabbit hole this morning? Not really. I did catch up on some podcasts I wanted to hear, and I got sideswiped or sidetracked in listening to the press conference this morning about from President Bush, not President Bush, oh my God, am I going back in time? Yes. The Trumpster, President Trump and Pence and his two flag guys, what's his name, the new guy on the block, McCarthy and Scalise and Nielsen about the border security and the discussion, the two-hour discussion they had this morning with the Democrats and the Republicans about the border wall and our budget. So that's where I got stuck. And then, of course, there were a couple of tweets there. People were commenting on little tiny snippets of the conversation from Trump. And I'm sorry, I'm not a Trumpster. I don't like his most of his what he stands for. And what he's doing in our country, but you can't afford to in this day and age to just listen to a snippet and respond because you hate him. It's just too dangerous to do that anymore. You have to listen to what's going on and in context. That's how I feel anyway. So I listened to the whole entire press conference. It was streamed live, of course. I think I saw it this time on. Could have listened to it on C-SPAN or seen it on C-SPAN, or any of one of the networks, the mainstream media networks, but I chose to watch it via Periscope this time. So there was obviously a streaming discussion as well. But, you know, overall, I was left with the thought that he's meaning well, and he's trying to make Congress get together and work on this, because the issue at our borders is decades old. And it has to be dealt with. It just can't go on any longer. I mean, I've seen the fallout in my state just alone. Our schools, everything is just inundated with immigrants, which is fine. We need to have our immigrants here. We need them to work, and we don't want to have closed borders necessarily. We're not trying to close off access to coming here. It's just that. It's been like an open door, basically. And I don't know how I really feel about all of the wall and all of that. I don't really know. I just know that it needs to be done in a proper way. And with this whole thing with the kids at the border, which I went down to see in the summer. And I didn't mean this to be a political post. I'm getting ready to read my book. But I'm just kind of reflecting on what happened to my morning. And I got all sucked into responding to things about this and I was just finishing up listening to some other podcasts so I could get my mind off of politics and back into the art world. Oh, excuse me. And I think I missed Larry's cast because I was listening to that other live broadcast. I'll have to catch Larry's later. Larry G. McGuire was doing a live broadcast with an artist from California, a musician, this morning at my noon, which is now almost 2 hours ago. So I'm really upset, and I did get the notice for it and everything. It said it notified me about half an hour ago, or half an hour before it started, and then I was watching this other thing. Anyway, I will catch up with Larry. But now I'm finally settling in to read the next part of my Growing Pains, the autobiography of Emily Carr. And we are starting a whole new few chapters. So I'll do that on the next piece of this cast. So here we are. I'm all bundled in my Danish sweater, my slippers, and my hat because it's still pretty cold out. And I'm noticing, oh, the mailman just passed my house. I must not have any mail today. Okay, here we are. The next chapter in Growing Pains, Emily Carr's autobiography, is called Life Class. Life class is like life drawing, I believe. When school opened Monday morning at 9 sharp, I was at the Westminster School of Art. I went first to the office, inquiring how I was to act. Mr. Ford took me up the broad stairway leading to the balcony off which our classrooms opened. There were two life rooms, quote-unquote life rooms, for women. Mr. Ford introduced me to the head student, a woman dour and middle-aged. Dour and middle-aged. I'm sorry. Okay. Ever worked from life? She snapped. Only portrait. It is usual for new students to work first in the antique class. I've had 3 years study in antique and still life at the San Francisco School of Art. The head student gave a mighty snort, grunted, "Colonial," with great disfavor. She had not the right to place me. Mr. Ford had put me into the life class. "Stars in the West bump pretty hard when they compete with civilized countries," she said acidly. "Well, Professor, we'll put you where you belong when he returns." She proceeded to put numbers on a lot of pieces of paper. The students were about to draw for a place in class.
Oh, excuse me.
I, being the new student, had the last number, and therefore no choice. Well, she seems to get the really brunt end of the deal a lot of times, doesn't she? Around the model throne were three rows of easels, low, higher, and high. Pose. The curtains of a little recess parted. Out stepped the model and took her place on the throne. I had dreaded this moment and busied myself preparing my material. Then I looked up. Her live beauty swallowed every bit of my shyness. I had never been taught to think of our naked bodies as something beautiful, only as something indecent, something to be hidden. Here was nothing but loveliness, only loveliness. A glad, life-lit body, a woman proud of her profession, proud of her shapely self, regal, illuminated, vital, high poised above our clothed in insignificance. The confusion of reassembly after the holidays stilled. Every eye was upon her as she mounted the throne, fell into pose. Every student was tallying her with perfection, summing up balance, poise, spacing, movement, weight, mood. Charcoal began to scrape on paper and canvas, swishing lines, jagged lines, subtle curves, soft smudge. Trembling, my own hand lifted the charcoal. I was away, lost in the subtlety, the play of line merging into line, curving, curve balancing curve. Rest. I could not believe the first 45 minutes had gone. The model broke pose, draped a kimono around herself, and sat on the edge of the platform to rest for 15 minutes. Students, too, relaxed, moving from easel to easel, looking, saying little. No one looked at my work, nor spoke to me. I was glad. Nevertheless, I was chilled by those cold students. In California, there was comradeship from the first day, and kindliness towards the new student. I was glad to hear pose, to see that serene creature with trembling life in every inch of her snap back into model queen of the room. Everything was for her. The notice on the outside of the door, life class, keep out, was for her. Heat, light, hush, all were for her. Unprotected flesh made us tender, protective, chivalrous. Her beauty delighted the artist in us. The illuminated glow of her flesh made sacred the bushy... It's busy hush that came and it came out bushy. Sorry, guys. Okay. The illuminated glow of her flesh made sacred the busy hush as we worked. Sorry. At 4 o'clock, the model stepped down from her throne, rubbed tired muscles a little, disappeared behind the curtain, emerged ordinary. A woman clothed shabbily, all the beauty she had lent us hidden. The professor did not return to his class for 2 weeks. I had but one fear during that time. Would I be turned back into the antique class? His criticisms were gruff, uninspiring. However, he let me stay in the life class. Mrs. Radcliffe. Mrs. Radcliffe was the aunt of friends of ours at home. They did not give me a letter of introduction, but wrote direct to her. They said to me, "Go and see Aunt Marion," and their faces sparkled at her mention. So, while waiting for school to open, I went. "I've heard all about you from my nieces," she said, "and I've accepted me as you accept a letter from the postman. It might be good. It may be good." Let me start again. Sorry. "I've heard all about you from my nieces," she said, "and accepted me as you accept a letter from the postman. It may contain good. It may contain bad." There I was. She received me kindly, but without demonstration. Mrs. Radcliffe was a widow with one son who was almost middle-aged, a London lawyer. She was Scotch by birth, and raising had spent her married life in Canada, but by inclination she was pure London through and through. Almost her first question to me was, "And how do you like London?" "I hate it." Her brown, starry eyes popped, grew angry, were hurt as if I'd hit her pet pup. She said, dear me," 4 times. "London is the most wonderful city in the world, child. It is stuffy, hard, and cruel. Canada is..." "Canada," biting the word off sharp. "Canada is crude." She spread her hands as if she would drip all memories of Canada from her fingertips. "London will soon polish Canada off you, smooth you, as your English parents were smooth. You are entitled to that. Make the most of your opportunities in London, child." "I am Canadian. I'm not English. I do not want Canada polished out of me."
Dear me," said Mrs. Radcliffe, shifting the conversation to her Canadian cousins and nieces. "Come to me whenever you want to, child. I'm always home on Sunday at tea time." We parted, feeling neither warm nor cold towards each other. I went to Mrs. Radcliffe's most Sundays. It got to be a habit. She liked me to come, and I liked going. Usually I stayed and went with Mrs. Radcliffe and her son, Fred, to evening service in Westminster Abbey, then back with them to supper. Son Fred saw me safely home. Fred was nearly twice my age. He was kindly, teased me about Canada. In his mother's presence, he pretended to be all English. She had educated him so. English schools, Cambridge University, taking him back to England as a small boy at the death of her husband. Down deep, Fred loved to remember his early boyhood in Canada. If he saw that I was dreary or homesick, he would chatter to me about the woods and the Indians. One night, Fred said, "Tell me about the comic old Indian who threw a tombstone overboard at the spot in the sea where his brother was drowned." I had been feeling morose at England, homesick for Canada that week. We all started to laugh at the Indian story. Suddenly, Fred, looking at me, said, "Now I see why the Indians called you Kleewick. Means laughing one, doesn't it?" After that, the Radcliffes always called me Kleewick. That's the name of her book, her first book.
which I have here to read, but I'm not going to read it into the audio. Mrs. Radcliffe's Sunday tea parties were always masculine for friends of Fred's. Mrs. Radcliffe never asked girls. Occasionally she had an old lady, a contemporary of her own. She gave out plainly that she intended to share her son's affections with no woman during her lifetime. She never thought of me as a woman. Besides, Fred liked girls stylish and very English. She was not afraid of his liking me. Mrs. Radcliffe was my English backbone. Her kind, practical strength of character was as a pole to a vine. In all my difficulties, I went to her. Mrs. Radcliffe had a dainty little old friend, lady friend called Mrs. Denny, who also was a widow with a son of a good deal younger than Fred. The two men were warm friends. Mrs. Denny had three little white curls dangling in front of each ear, and wore widow bonnets with long crepe weepers dangling behind. She was fragile, pink and white, and lowest low, evangelical in religion. Mrs. Radcliffe leaned towards the high church. The ladies never discussed degrees of ritual, but confined conversation to their sons and to London. Mrs. Denny was as tabid. Sorry, I don't know what I'm doing. I think I'm having trouble with the light in here again. I need to go have my eyes checked again, I think. Mrs. Denny was as rabid, not tabid, was as rabid as a Londoner. Rabid a Londoner as Mrs. Radcliffe. She was as anxious to see son Ed, happily married before she died, as Mrs. Radcliffe was determined that her son Fred should remain a bachelor. The ladies put their heads together and decided that with some taming down and brushing up, I would be all right as a wife for Ed Denny. The first thing to be done was to fill me with London, that I would be quite weaned from the crudities of Canada. Mrs. Denny said to me, "My dear, you stick far too close to that art school. Confinement is telling on your health. Now I tell you what we will do. Every Thursday, my daughter Lou and I will call at your school at noon, take you out to lunch. Then we will spend the afternoon exploring London. You will come back to dinner with us, and Ed will see you home." "But my work, Mrs. Denny." "One afternoon a week will make no difference. There is more to be learned in life than art." "Art is what I came over to London for." "Who knows? You may love here. You may love here. You may never want to go back to Canada." "Oh, I hope not. I would not want that." She kissed me very fondly, pinching my cheek. Then her fingers took hold of a little cornelian cross that I wore. "Don't wear this as an ornament, child. It savors of R.C. She never said, quote-unquote, Roman Catholics out loud, only whispered R.C. Once I saw her take a half-crown from her purse to tip a beef-eater who had conducted us round the Tower of London. Her hand was half out when the sun glinted on a little cross dangling from his watch chain. She slipped the half crown back into her purse, substituted a shilling for it. Under Mrs. Denny's guidance, I saw a lot of London. She always carted a little red boudicaire under her arm with the sight. We were doing marked by a slip of paper. I must be saying that wrong. Baedeker. We stood before the site and read Baedeker and tried to memorize the date. The wretched part of these excursions was Ed's meeting us for tea. When we came out of the tea shops, Lou and her mother always took a quick wrong turn on purpose and left me alone with him for the rest of the time. I would say, "Oh dear," in dismay, and start hunting them. But Ed only laughed and said, "Don't worry. Mother knows her way.
about London, as well as the nose on her face. They will be waiting at home. But it provoked me. English women were horrid about this marrying business. They seemed to think the aim of every girl was to find a husband. Girls' students adored their stuck-up autocratic art masters, or their clergy, or their employers. Men and women students did not work together in the Westminster Art School. I was glad. English husband-seeking girls shamed me. Miss Green's PGs were all women, all silly. Shortly after I came to Miss Green's, two men came up to London to see me. One was an Englishman from Liverpool, whom I had met out in Canada. The other was the ship's doctor, an Irishman. The Englishman was a brother of Frank Pennington, whom I had so detested as a child at home. Clifton had visited Frank in Canada. He did not ask me to marry him there, but came home to think it over and wasted a postage stamp on it. I could not have been more emphatic in saying no, but as soon as he found I was in London, he came from his home in Liverpool to see how I looked in English setting. He sat very uncomfortably on the edge of a chair in Miss Green's drawing room. The PGs were all in a twitter. When Clifton had got as red as he could get, he said, "Shall we go out and see some sights?" Anything was better than that horrible drawing room, so I said, "That would be nice. What shall we see?" I have always had a hanker to see Madame Tussauds' waxworks, said Clifton. And off we went. We punched the real policeman, asked the wax policeman the way, tried to buy a catalogue from the wax dummy, watched the chest of the Sleeping Beauty hoist and flop. Then we came to the head of a dark little stair, and a man asked us for an extra sixpence. Over the drop into a cellar was the notice, "Chamber of Horrors. Expectant mothers and nervous persons warned." Need we, Clifton? Of course. Sinking into that dim underworld was horrid. Red glistened and dripped Red glistened and dripped from a severed head in the guillotine. King somebody was lying in a bath of red ink, having cut his veins in suicide. Indians were scalping, murderers murdering, villains being villainous. Once outside again, even the dirty London air seemed pure. What next, Clifton? Well, I thought, Euston Station? Must you be going so soon? I said politely. Not for several hours yet. Want to see the engines? Very newest models, you know. I said, oh. Clifton was an engineer. Engines were meat and drink to him. He ran from platform to platform, patting the snorting brutes as they slithered panting into their places, calling them beauties, explaining their internals to me. You sit here. There is the 4:30 special. I must see her, the very, very newest. I sat down on a luggage truck while he ran and dodged and ducked. Then I saw him engage the engineer in conversation. They investigated every bolt and screw of the miserable thing. He came back exhilarated. Going to let me ride home in the cab with him. Starts in an hour. Time for tea first. We went to an ABC and ate crumpets. Goodbye. His hand was clammy with excitement. He gasped, "Very latest model." He grabbed my hand. Oh, this is funny. He grabbed my hand. "It's been splendid. The Chamber of Horrors, the engines, you..." I was relieved. It was so delightfully plain that this was to be our final meeting. The Irish doctor's ship was in port. The doctor came to London and to the art school. Impatient young man downstairs in the museum waiting to see our young Canadian. Mr. Ford smiled at me and gave my arm an affectionate little pat. Young man, unable to wait till the janitor was free, ordered my old bones to run upstairs and fetch you at once. He rubbed a rheumatic knee. dear old man. Descending the stair, we saw that the janitor's amble was unusually brisk. He came lashing his feather duster and glowering down the aisle between the architectural tombs. There sat the little Irish ship's doctor on the stomach of a great one, impatiently kicking his heels against its stone sofa. "Oh, doctor, their stomachs are sacred. Please don't." He jumped down. "Shall we go into St. James Park and sit on a bench? It is quite close." It was a wide bench. The doctor sat down on one end and I on the other. Soon he was so close to my end of the bench that I fell off. I walked around the bench and sat down on its other end. He did not look nearly so nice or nearly so well-bred in plain clothes. He was ill at ease, too, trying to make conversation. I said, "Don't they squabble?" meaning the sparrows who, down in the dust, were having a battle over a crust. A dove swooped down and took the crust. "Gentlest of all birds, a dove," sighed the doctor. He was slithering up the bench again. "Doves squabble like the dickens," I replied. The doctor said, "Your tongue is losing its Canadian twist. You have changed in these few months. "I should hope so. Wasn't I flabby and ghastly? Let's walk." I jumped up just as his hand touched my arm. We strode silent 3 times around the duck pond. "What time is it? Being late for dinner is one of the unpardonable sins in England. Goodbye." I held out my hand. He hurried south, I north. Neither looked back. Was it his uniform, not he, that had been a little attractive? Perhaps doctors, too, prefer girls meek and sick. But for that hint, I was grateful to the doctor. I was trying to speak more like the English, ashamed a little of what they ridiculed as my colonialisms. Bless you, doctor, for the warning. Unconsciously, I'd tried to be less different from the other students. I, who had seen many Canadian-born girls go to England to be educated and come back more English than the English, I had despised them for it. I was grateful for the doctor's visit, and I swore to myself I would go home to Canada as Canadian as I left her. Thank you for listening to that. Our next chapter will be Mrs. Simpson's, which is sort of a short chapter. I thought about adding it to this one, but I thought that's enough. And then leaving Miss Green's Vincent Square is sort of lengthy, so that'll be in the next reading, and possibly Payne and Mrs. Radcliffe, The Vicarage. We are about 140 pages in, 142 pages in, and I'm still liking the story. I hope you are, and I hope you have a nice afternoon or evening, or if it's your morning, have a good one.